and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next up, we have More Talk Radio with guest host Linda Olsen Osterlund. She'll be talking with guest Mike German, talking about a new domestic terrorism bill.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Festival of Nations on Saturday, September 7th, 11 a.m. at the Extended Home LLC building in Portland. The Festival of Nations celebrates and embraces the diversity of the Division Midway District of Portland. There will be cultural foods, vendors, activities, community services, and more. Again, that's the Festival of Nations on Saturday, September 7th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Extended Home LLC building, 14410 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found on the KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. This is Linda Olsen Osterlund. I am your host for Voices from the Edge this morning. Cecil and Celeste have taken the holiday off, and I'm happy to be here filling in for them. I know it's a holiday morning, and maybe you're waking up a little slow, but I have a great guest for you today. His name is Michael German, and he is a former special agent with the FBI, specializing in domestic terrorism and covert operations. He's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security program. He's also the author of Thinking Like a Terrorist, Insights of a Former FBI Undercover Agent. He's also the author of an upcoming book. It's being published, released officially September 10th, and it's it is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And so this is Michael German. He's also, and why I've got him on today, he's written an article that is about a very important subject coming up. And the article he wrote is entitled, What in the World is Adam Schiff Thinking with His Domestic Terrorism Bill? And he wrote it for The Hill. Welcome to KBOO, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, and thank you for coming in. I know you were on vacation and you stepped in to do this anyway, and I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I believe that a lot of people in Portland may know you. You don't know me, but I know you because I've seen you down at the JTTF hearings when the city council was considering whether or not to continue to be part of the task force and joint terrorism task force, and you were arguing that we should not because of civil liberties concerns. You were one of the featured speakers at the last time, and part of helping us decide not to stay part of the joint terrorism task force. So I appreciate that, and I hope others in Portland appreciate your efforts in those directions.
Thanks very much. Again, it was my pleasure. I commend Portland for being the first to challenge that style of working with the FBI.
Yeah, I feel there's some weaknesses in how we've stopped it, but we can take those on as we go forward, and I think we'll need to. You can never not have to pay attention to these agreements. We've had them in the past,
right,
and not have them followed very well by the other side, so we'll keep our eye on that. Today we're talking about the What in the World is Adam Schiff Thinking with His Domestic Terrorism Bill? And let's explain to people who don't follow The Hill that he's a representative from California, a Democrat. He's chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. And he has said in the past that he doesn't trust William Barr. So talk about what this issue is and what's coming up. Tell us about this new bill that he is touting, and it's a Democrat touting it. So you see a lot of talk about it being bipartisan and being reasonable.
Mm-hmm. So the issue is about the Justice Department for the past 4 or 5 years, even before the Trump administration took over, the last couple of years of the Obama administration, has been promoting the idea that there is no law against domestic terrorism. So that explains why they're so slow to address far-right violence, violence by white supremacists and other militants, because they don't have a domestic terrorism law. And that's actually not true. We wrote a report at the Brennan Center back in October called Wrong Priorities on Fighting Terrorism that showed there were 51 federal laws of terrorism that apply to domestic cases, but also that's somewhat of a semantic trick as well, because when you open a domestic terrorism case, in the 90s, I worked undercover in domestic terrorism cases targeting white supremacists and anti-government militias, and nobody suggested we didn't have laws. Of course, there are all kinds of federal laws, and the types of crimes that these groups commit violate those laws. So there was no limit to what you could charge somebody with if you found evidence against them. So it was somewhat surprising to me in about 2015 when I started hearing this mantra that there isn't a domestic terrorism law. We need to pass a broad new law. And
Michael, I remember back right about then, and maybe you remember it, there was a Martin Luther King Day parade in Spokane, Washington, and there was an avowed white supremacist who left bombs that he was hoping would get the people who were parading. And they chose not to. At that time, I remember it was one of those glaring cases of they chose not to try him with a hate crime. And we have hate crimes, and that could have added 20 years, I believe, onto the sentence. That's
right.
One of the kinds of things you're talking about. They had laws they could apply. They just chose not to.
Right. And I can understand any individual case, a prosecutor trying to make the best decision about the evidence that he or she has and the facts of the case, to put a case together to make sure the person goes away for some time. And that person did go to prison for quite a while. So
I hope he's still there. He really really intended to have that bomb go off and hit just the participants marching.
Right. So,
or of course, according to what they found.
Right, exactly. But the point is there are laws.
Right.
And this argument that there weren't laws worried me, so that's why I wrote this report, Wrong Priorities on Fighting Terrorism, to show the multitude, literally dozens of laws that are used to target people in this category of crimes that the federal government say calls domestic terrorism. And that includes not just these federal crimes of terrorism, but hate crimes that you mentioned, also organized crime statutes, these statutes
like RICO and racketeering.
Exactly. They're written to originally to go after the mafia, but they work against any organized group. I mean, a lot of public corruption cases, they actually use organized crime statutes to prosecute, so they're very powerful statutes. I mean, people would argue that they're too powerful, that they give the government too much power, so it was kind of odd to me that the government would be arguing they didn't have enough authority, but particularly because I worked these cases in the 1990s, and nobody suggested we didn't have ample authority to go after people who were intending to do harm. And so I wrote the first report, but it kept on, and they would play this semantic game where they said, well, those federal laws of terrorism, they don't say domestic terrorism. We acknowledge they apply to domestic terrorism, but they don't say the word domestic, so that's really the problem. That's why we need a new law, which, of course, is just
not
silly, but
yeah.
But continued to maintain this, and then we started to see legislation that was following along with this, and many different groups worked with legislators to try to explain to them what the problem was, and I wrote another report called fighting far-right violence and hate crimes to show that the lack of enforcement around far-right violence is a policy choice. It's actually written in policy. It has nothing to do with the law. There are plenty of laws. But the FBI, as a matter of policy, when a white supremacist commits a crime, they can either call it domestic terrorism because there's a statute that defines domestic terrorism as deadly violence intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population. So most hate crimes fit that definition. So they could call it domestic terrorism. If they do that, it's their number one priority. If they instead call it a hate crime, it drops down to their number five priority. And worse, the Justice Department's policy is that hate crimes are deferred to state and local prosecutions. So the FBI doesn't even look at those crimes once it designates them as hate crimes. And in fact, if you look at where white supremacists are mostly prosecuted by the federal government, it says gang crimes. And that's the sixth priority out of eight missing priorities. So it drops down in importance to the FBI, plus that information, even when they make cases. And again, they have plenty of statutes, so they can, I don't have any problem calling them gangs. They are gangs. I don't have problem calling these crimes hate crimes. They are hate crimes. But the problem is it deprioritizes the investigation and it hides the data, right? So when these people are prosecuted under these other statutes, they don't call that domestic terrorism data. So murders that are prosecuted as gang crimes don't count in the data, and they still try to maintain a public perception that white supremacists are not the biggest of the domestic terrorism threat.
And I do think that liberals and leftists and have been talking about this for a while. You know, there was the eco-terrorism bills passed, and they seem to mostly serve an industry in trying to silence critics, not really anything that had to do with terrorism in the sense of threats to life of people or threats to even really that much harm to property. And yet at the same time, it would seem like ones like that Spokane one or you know, the very, like Harney County, the takeover in Malheur County and Harney County of federal lands was barely prosecuted, I have to say. It's like if I had graffitied the front porch of the federal building, I for sure would do more time than those guys did for what they did. And so it's been an area where there's been a lot of concern from the left side of the aisle.
Absolutely, and I understand the concern because of the enforcement, but what's driving the lack of enforcement is a Justice Department policy, not the law.
Right, I hear you.
Right, so the Justice Department is deciding, and in fact, the FBI for many years was very upfront saying that eco-terrorism is the number one domestic threat, even though there's not a single homicide related to the environmental activist movement in 30, 40 years. I mean, I don't know of any of it.
And people are doing long, long, long sentences for things that didn't harm an individual at all.
Exactly. And you know, where there's a serious arson that risks human life, you know, that's one thing. But when you're ranking these groups to look at the persistent deadly violence coming from white supremacists and other far-right militants, and overlooking that and saying eco-terrorism is the number one threat showed that it was no longer based on an objective assessment. This was a political decision that was being made.
Absolutely.
And in fact, you're right. They passed an excess law that gave them a more aggressive attitude that they could go after these people. Mm-hmm. And that's my concern with this claim now, because they lack no legal authority to go after the far-right violence. They choose not to. So when they're asking for this new law, I look at who they're actually trying to get. And that's when you look at the Black Lives Matter protests and how their police and the Standing Rock oil protectors, how those protests were policed, the Disrupt J20 protest, the anti-Trump protest after the inauguration, where the government rounded up 230 people who happened to be standing next to where some windows got broken, or in the vicinity of where some windows got broken, and charged them all with felonies. And they had to fight felony charges for a year.
Wow.
Before they were all dismissed.
And really changes a person's life to have to take on defending themselves against that crime. I want to let the audience know that I'm speaking with Michael German, a former FBI special agent, but now an author who is speaking out and talking about issues related to terrorism and how they're being covered. Today we're talking about his article, What in the World is Adam Schiff Thinking with His Domestic Terrorism Bill? I want to let you know I'm going to open the phone lines, and that's for you too, Michael. I'm going to open the phone lines out there. We're hoping that some of you out there in the sleepy morning of Labor Day, it's very quiet out there in the town, but we're hoping you're awake and you're listening and you have questions and concerns that you want to talk to Michael German about. The number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. I'm going to take just a few more minutes for Michael to tell us about this new bill, the Confronting the Threat of Domestic Terrorism Act, which Schiff is introducing, and then we'll start you taking your calls. So hold on if you're already on the line, and we'll be back to you in a few minutes. Okay, Michael, so we've watched this sort of developing over the years, and you have recognized a real concern often associated with the left, which is that how will they use these laws and how do they intend to use this new law? But coming from a Democrat, we're sort of, and coming in the midst of these really horrendous mass killings,
right. It
seems like, oh, maybe this is an answer. So talk about that.
So Representative Schiff identified three cases, the Charlottesville attack, the Pittsburgh killing, and the recent El Paso attack, all white supremacist attacks. But mm-hmm. the part that he leaves out is that those Alex Fields was charged with a federal hate crime, which subjected him to the death penalty. Robert Bowers also charged with death penalty eligible crimes. The U.S. attorney in El Paso said this is an act of domestic terrorism that meets the definition under the statute. We're going to prioritize it as such, and we'll use the strongest charge we can find when we ultimately prosecute him. So there's no lack of legal authority to address those crimes.
Even in the claims that it's interesting that he would throw out cases that sort of were the opposite of his point, and I think that shows how they count on the public not really going deeply into these things.
Right, and being afraid that, oh, there, you know, if somebody from the Justice Department is telling me that these horrible crimes, there's no law I can use to stop them, of course they would demand a new law. But when you look at how this law was shaped, it's shaped in a way that's so overbroad the government can use it against anyone, and even people who are just breaking windows and engaging in heated political rhetoric. And the problem with Representative Schiff's bill is it gives the Attorney General, who, as you said in the outset, he has been very clear that he does not trust this person, right, because he's been involved in the Trump-Russia investigations,
right.
and
Barr has been pretty much he's been pretty clear that he'll do anything Trump wants him to do, and he'll work
right.
hard to protect Trump against any illegalities he might commit.
And Schiff criticized William Barr for mischaracterizing this report that came out from Special Counsel Mueller. So he actually said, I quote him in the article, he said at one point that William Barr was the second most dangerous man in the country. But his bill would give William Barr the power to name which people out there who might have broken windows or engaged in other
acts of vandalism. Maybe people used to spray paint buildings on protests in the Vietnam War, I remember.
Right, and it has to be dangerous to Cuban safety, but that's a very low bar, and you're giving this person you don't trust that power. And when you look at how the Justice Department has used that power to go after the Black Lives Matter activists, to go after the Standing Rock protesters, to go after the J20 protesters, that's where they're not getting convictions. That's where they would need excess law in order to get convictions. And And so that's the where I'm afraid that that would be.
That's what's going to happen with the new law and what it's going to do.
But that's how it would be used.
Well,
yes, because they
thank you, Michael. We do
policy.
Have a couple people on the line who want to talk to you. Let's let them on the line, sure. And then you get out the information you need to as we go. Jeremy, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, the only thing Schiff has ever said that I liked was that thing about Barr, but I always hated
right.
him. I think that, you know, your run-of-the-mill, naive liberal Democrat should trusting somebody like Schiff is kind of like going into McDonald's and being surprised that, you know, they don't have five veggie burgers on the menu, you know.
Right.
What we're selling here is, you know, is bad actions by a bipartisan group that is opposed to any left-wing suggestion that maybe things could change. I'm sorry, I just tuned in, but I'm surely you've talked about the last couple of months in Portland with Antifa being effectively, you know, made into the equivalent, you know, by media manipulation, made into the equivalent of open fascists with murderous open murderous proclamations.
Well, Jeremy, you know, we haven't actually talked about that yet, and I would like to hear what Michael German has to say about that. Michael, have you been tracking that?
I went to high school with Bill Barr, and he was a couple years ahead of me. We're planning our 50th reunion. He's class of 67, I'm 69. Our 50th is coming up. We've been trying to track down his brother, who's rumored to be in the CIA, and I would not be surprised if he's a major.
Is this Jeremy still?
Yeah, it is.
Jeremy, let me have Michael weigh in on what's been happening here locally.
Okay,
right.
Can I finish my Barr anecdote? Because it's pretty funny.
Oh,
yeah, I mean, it's
sure,
really about
sure.
his brother. It takes 30 seconds. Anyway, at the 40th, 10 years ago, I went to a prep school, fancy Horace Mann. Roy Cohen went to my prep school. Elliot Spitzer went to my prep school. Yeah, really wonderful people go there. I mean, Tony Lewis went there too. It's not that bad. Anyway, so in the there's an editorial. Hillary was like the assistant editor, and he was a right winger. Barr's brother was a creep. He'd been beating me up since nursery school. Anyway, there's a picture of me with my hair slightly over my ears, and then to illustrate Hillary's editorial, saying this is the decline of civilization because the best prep school in the country is no longer forcing its students to cut their hair, and I was
right.
the illustration. So and his older brother is getting a second chance to destroy the country. He's off being a CIA operative, and it's really weird, you know, that they're getting away with this.
Well,
anyway,
yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So I am 100% in agreement with you on the Antifa question, that there has been this right-wing push to make Antifa sound like it's a problem, and unfortunately it has permeated law enforcement. So I think that's why we see a lot of the aggressive reaction from law enforcement. But even reading some of their materials, I mean, one of them, I think, characterized the inanity of it, where it said the problem with these protests is there's this group called Antifa, and then there's these people that come out to resist Antifa called anti-Antifa.
That's really not
it's like turning the world on its head, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Exactly right. We don't have to guess how the Trump administration would use this new power. They've already said. Donald Trump tweeted that Antifa is the problem. So it's very clear that this law, and again, if you look in the history about how authoritarian governments come to power from a democratic government, what they do is they unleash thugs to commit political violence against the population, and then when the public gets tired of that public violence, they authorize the government to pass a strong law that outlaws that kind of protest.
Yes.
And that seems to be the direction we're heading, and for it to come from, as you said, a Democratic representative is difficult, because there have been a lot of hearings. The House Homeland Security Committee has had hearings, the House Judiciary Committee has had hearings on this issue to talk about what the real problems are. So for this bill to come out that totally ignores the information that Congress has been compiling about how to better address this problem, is highly problematic, and there are some Republican-sponsored bills that mirror what Schiff is asking for. So,
right.
Unfortunately, this is a live issue.
I think one of the good things it does is it reveals to us once again how a lot of the Democrats are not very different than their Republicans when it comes to issues of protest and demonstration and civil liberties of those sorts. They claim a higher mantle, but they often aren't in terms of what bills that they choose to pass. We do have another caller on the line, so I want to bring him on the line. That's Mike. Mike, are you there? I'm not hearing you, Mike. If you're there, we're trying to go to you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I've got you. Thank you, Mike.
Okay.
Did you have a question for Michael Brennan? I mean, Michael German.
Yeah. Sure, yeah, Mike. Just to say, actually, I was at the council hearing last year, and I just sort of watched, and that was, I much appreciate you coming out, Mr. German. My question... I guess would be in the sense that where, you know, it is still possible, you know, you explained that there's a policy decision or, you know, policy choice that's driving the decision not to really prosecute far-right extremism. It's still, I'd say, in this environment, you know, possible to change the political kind of discussion, which can ostensibly get policy change. Where would you see, what kind of a, is there a type of incident or a line that could be crossed in the sense of, you know, some kind of a terror attack or some sort of an event that would actually force a change? Like, I don't know if it has to be the scale of like an Oklahoma City bombing, and then whether there would be a desperate attempt to try and shape a narrative after any incident to try and, you know, constrain it to a story that would say, oh no, it was just mental health or it's just something else. But what,
right.
What would be some examples?
So I'm afraid that there is this effort to use to what, you know, thankfully are not near the scope of Oklahoma City, but are still horrific in the number of victims they're producing, the El Paso shooting, the Pittsburgh shooting, to use the fear and the public demand that something be done to pass this law that isn't really addressing it. And if you look back to Oklahoma City, that's exactly what happened. They passed a law that cracked down on immigration.
Oh, that was the cause. I didn't know Timothy McVeigh was an immigrant.
Right, exactly. It really didn't do very much to address far-right violence. So it's that same sort of knee-jerk, but the way the intelligence community works is they turn every failure into a success for them. Right, they get more power, they get more resources, and we're continuing in that spiral where they keep failing to protect us, and yet we reward them with new powers and new resources. So, what in working with some of the other people in Congress, you know, what we tried to argue in our report is that we need is objective data, because I believe that the public, if they have access to the objective data, will compel the government to act correctly. If they know that all the homicides in this field we call domestic terrorism are coming from the far right, and yet all the investigations or the majority of investigations are targeting these groups that, you know, perhaps engage in some property damage but are not actually killing people, they would demand that, okay, we need to reorganize our resources to make sure we're focused on the most deadly threats. And those threats come from the far right, so we have to direct our resources there. And in fact, Senator Durbin introduced a bill in 2017.
I saw that bill when I was looking up this one. It's called... go ahead.
It's called the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, and it would demand that data. But the FBI, I'm sure when they saw the bill, even though it hasn't passed, I'm sure they ran numbers and knew that the numbers were going to look terrible for them. So they reorganized the way they account for their cases. They categorized their cases to mask how many cases were against white supremacists versus how many were against what they call black identity extremists, right? Because there's no group that calls itself Black Identity Extremists.
No, and in fact, that Black Identity Extremists allows them to look at all the Black Lives Matter organizations and anything like that, which we know they have done. There's been a case here where they were even looking into an Oregon Department of Justice agent's own Facebook because they decided that because he supported Black Lives Matter or he even mentioned it on his Facebook that he might be a threat. I want to let our listening audience know that they can call in. It's 503-231-8187. And I'm going to take a moment just to let you know what's coming up on KBOO this morning. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, which burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, it's going to be Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, an important environmental program of ours. And at 11, it's going to be First Voices Radio. That's First Voices Indigenous People Radio that you'll be hearing. That's all here on KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, your guest host for Voices from the Edge today, and I'm talking with Michael German about his recent article in The Hill called What in the World is Adam Schiff Thinking with His Domestic Terrorism Bill? And I want to let you, the audience, know again that you can call in at 503-231-8187. We want to hear from you about your concerns and your thoughts about this issue. Michael, I was noticing in the way that they frame this new bill, they use words like intimidate as if it's the same as terrorize. So I decided to just look up intimidate and terrorism just for the fun of it to see if, in fact, they were synonyms of each other. And when I looked up terrorize, the synonyms for it were things like affright, alarm, frighten, horrify, panic, scare, scarify, shock, spook, startle, etc. Also, words related to it were appall, bowl over, dismay, shake up, amaze, demoralize. But nowhere in there do you find intimidate. And so I looked up intimidate. I wanted to see what are the synonyms of intimidate. And there are things like blackjack, bogart, browbeat, bulldoze, bully, cow, hector, strong arm. Words related to intimidate are bluster, trash talk. And then it does have one place where it goes into affright, alarm, frighten, horrify, also menace, terrorize, and threaten. And then onward, it goes back to badger, bludgeon, coerce, demoralize. These are all from, I think it was Merriam-Webster's Book of Thesaurus. And I brought that up because it seems to me that they've certainly turned in this bill things that could, quote, intimidate a person could be called terrorizing a person. And for me, the experiences are both unpleasant but not the same.
Right. It's extremely broad language, and it's not just to intimidate or coerce a civilian audience, but also to coerce a change in a government policy. So that's the definition.
Oh, yeah. We could coerce a change in government policy with.
Right. Right. So again, it broadens the idea that we're not talking about deadly violence against people, but rather these other sorts of threats and property damage that looks like the bill is more targeted to making it easier to prosecute protesters rather than focusing the resources on the most deadly threats. And you know, there are other bills out there that do similar things. There's the Domestic Terrorism Data Act that would demand data from the FBI, because again, they changed their categories. One of the things they did is they mixed far-right militias with what they call anarchists, because again, in the United States, there are no deaths from anarchism in the last several decades. You know, we'd have to go back to the early 1900s.
During labor strikes, et cetera, right, or something.
The groups that fall under the category of far-right militias who kill people, you know, and we're talking about a low level of violence compared to the 17,000 homicides we have in the United States each year. But if you're going to have this category of domestic terrorism and the Congress defines it as deadly violence, we have to focus where there's the most deadly violence. But the government is trying to hide the data. which is what these bills are trying to get at. Because I think once the public sees the data, they'll demand that they focus on the most deadly threats and not against protesters.
Yeah, and the language, in broadening the language that way, it really, I mean, obviously protests are intended to influence the government. And, I mean, even, you know, it made me think the teacher strikes, which were huge this right. last year, they would almost slide in there, or part of them could, if the right officials wanted to make them fit into that.
Absolutely. It would be very easy. And that's the history of how these powers have been used, right? I mean, we know that the FBI in the early 1900s used its law enforcement and national security powers to go after the labor movement, to go after the anti-war movement. We know that they did that again in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And it was only when after the Church Committee investigation that uncovered these abuses that they put in guidelines that were designed to regulate that sort of use of law enforcement powers where there was no reasonable indication of criminal activity. Unfortunately, after 9/11, those rules
everything
were watered
changed,
down
didn't it?
Significantly. Right.
Everything
so
changed
that's
after
why,
9/11.
And that's why the JTTF became a problem, right? When I worked on the Joint Terrorism Task Force in the 1990s, the FBI's rules were at least equal to and usually stronger than any state and local rules. So when the state and local participated with the FBI, they had to apply FBI rules. So it heightened everybody. But once the FBI lowered their rules, they were bringing in police departments like Portland Police that actually had stronger regulations than the FBI did, and then telling them you should work through the FBI's rules. So it was had the effect of lowering the protections for the private citizens.
I see what you're saying. We do have another caller on the line. It's Mike. Are you there, Mike?
Oh, you still have me on?
Oh, I still have you on. I'm sorry, Mike. That was a mistake. We intended you to be cut off. I apologize.
Thanks, Mike.
No, that's okay. But
thank you, Mike.
I'll just say last.
Sure.
Well, it's a little tough to say, you know, in this era that data can square off against narrative. And that's, you know, kind of a sad reality of where we are, and I appreciate that effort to try and remove the obscurity or the attempt to obscure that far-right violence. It vastly exceeds anything coming from the other side, and I don't know if you have any comment about that. I'm just thinking of like Christopher Hitchens saying that, you know, narrative trumps facts.
Well, and
like
I do
that.
Think you're. I think you've got a real point there, Mike. I think that, but I think narrative always will, in a way, because I think that's part of human beings. We want to hear the story, and so if you can tell us a good story that catches our emotions, part of us is always going to be leaning towards that. That's why we need to have, honorable enforcement of laws and strict meanings for what the laws are, rather than broad, open-ended ones that can affect more people. I do want to let the listeners know
sure.
that you can call in. It's 503-231-8187. This is an important issue for us here in Portland. As we all know, I think they would love to make what they call Antifa disappear and be able to jail them for things that are not crimes. I was down at the last demonstration, the one that got so big on the news because of the different handling, and there was a different way of handling it from the police. But I had I am anti-fascist poster on front of me. It was actually like a sign with, you know, that you can wear over your shoulders, and I had gotten it at another demonstration. Somebody else made it, but I had about 20 people take pictures of me, and it took a while for me to figure out it's because I just look like some ordinary little old lady who's saying I am an anti-fascist, and that was an anomaly, because anti-fascists were being called Antifa, were being called the purveyors of violence, and here I obviously wasn't a purveyor of violence, but you know, the majority of us who are anti-fascists aren't purveyors of violence. That's why we're anti-fascist. They are purveyors of violence and violence against certain people.
That's right. I mean, technically, my work as an FBI agent in the 1990s and the rest of the Joint Terrorism Task Force agents that worked with me were anti-fascist, because we were working cases against white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups. So you're absolutely right. This narrative that has demonized the resistance to white supremacist violence as the problem. It's highly problematic, and you know, I recognize that it's always tough to go after a well-resourced movement that is trying to change the language, but I think if there is objective data, it's harder to make the narrative work.
I agree with you. I support the Southern Poverty Law Center for being able to give us information about hate crimes and names of groups and stuff in different cities, different states throughout the nation, so that we have some of that more concrete data to go from. Especially since our law enforcement agencies throughout the nation do not in any uniform way keep track of events so that we can know what kind of events they were. Can you talk a little bit, Michael German, about some of the difficulties we've had here in Portland when they've overbroadly used laws? I remember you wrote about in 2012 how there was a group of young people that got caught up because they had intended to go up to Seattle for a protest. Can you bring that back to our audience again so that they can remember what's been done here by overbroad use of terrorism threats?
Sure. Again, what bothered me when I started to hear these current and former Justice Department officials saying they don't have the authority to go after domestic terrorism was that I'd spent the previous 5 or 6, 7 years challenging the government's overbroad use of these the current authorities they have to target protesters. And we saw that with the Seattle May Day protest, where it got unruly and there was some window breaking and that sort of thing. But because one of the windows was a U.S. courthouse window, the FBI got involved. And they conducted multi-state raids, you know, these SWAT raids. And always when I see that kind of activity, I look for the search warrant affidavit, what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And they weren't looking for guns, they weren't looking for bombs, they weren't looking for other deadly devices. They were looking for picket signs and black clothing. And this was clear indication to me that what they were looking for wasn't really deadly violence, but rather the unruly protest.
And people they hoped were anarchists. They hoped that the black clothing would represent them being anarchists.
Exactly. And this idea that the anarchists were the big threat when you have white supremacists killing people every year was just an improper use of resources. But it wasn't without cost. They actually used a grand jury and subpoenaed people to the grand jury, including people who weren't even at the protest, and were trying to get information about their friends and others in the protest movements they were involved in. And to their credit, they refused to testify and took the brunt of that and had to spend months in prison, in jail, waiting for the grand jury to expire.
Over
a broken window.
Yeah,
and
when we say the grand juries have incredible power, and I know at that time some people who knew some of the young people in the sort of like a grouping around these people, not the direct involved, but some of those literally left town because they were so terrified that if they got picked up in jail that they couldn't tolerate it, that their mental health would not be able to survive it. And so they literally like gave up everything they were trying to do and left the area in fright from what the FBI were actually doing. And they did hold young people for quite a long time who never committed a crime. And I want to say we have Chelsea Manning right now being held under these kind of grand jury holds because she's refusing to testify in a case that they want her to. And I believe when the case was going, when they're trying to prove that Clinton, you know, they're trying to impeach Clinton, they also took a family friend of his, I think her name was McDougal, and mm-hmm. held her for many months, I think over a year, with the grand jury. And so these are very onerous things, the grand juries, when they hold you, and they're holding you just for not giving them information, not for a crime that you've committed, not for something you've done. And of course, being held can really seriously damage some people's mental health. It's been well proven. So I
think and one of the things that I talk about in my new book is how in these cases, if you look at the J20, if you look at these Seattle May Day cases, I don't think the government is really trying to win these cases. I think they're just trying to increase the cost of protesting. So today, if you're going to go out and protest against white supremacist violence, you might get hurt by white supremacists who have been left free to commit violence at these rallies and then walk away with few charges, if any, coming from that kind of violence. You might get beat up by the police officers who respond thinking that the resistance to white supremacy is a problem. Or you might get charged with a felony just because you were close to where something bad happened. And so the costs of protesting go up.
Yes.
And I think that's really the intent behind this aggressive pursuit of these cases is to just make other people say, well, it's not worth it for me to go into the street. And of course, once they can get people not to go into the street, it's a lot easier to put in place policies that the public disagrees with.
Yes. And you mentioned your new book, and I do want to bring that up. You've got a new book coming out. September 10th is the official date of the release. It's Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. It's a great title. So that'll be coming up, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to have you on KBOO in your round of with that book as you're going around speaking
sure.
about it. It'll be an important book for us to hear about. excuse me, I brought up that 2012 case also because in the news coverage of the case, it turned out we got a lot of information about how the FBI were operating, and you know they were following them, following these young people on their way to Seattle. And one thing I found interesting, which I think all activists should know, is that they can listen to, they can read text messages in real time. So they were happily reading what people were texting to each other about where they were going and where they were going to meet, et cetera. And so that's one power that they have because they're federal agents and because the way that surveillance has changed over the years. I think a lot of people don't know that their texts can be read while they're doing it. And, of course, a lot of people publicize their protests on Facebook and do everything directly out in the open to not have
right.
to worry about them, you know, finding something secret because you're not doing anything illegal. You're carrying out your civil liberties. But there are many cases, maybe you're going to do something like stop a train from, you know, from carrying crude oil across a set of tracks or something like that, where you might want to keep private what your plans were before you enacted them. And it's important to know that in this era, the surveillance is much more extensive than it used to be.
Right. And you know, nonviolent civil disobedience has an honored history in this country of compelling legal change to expand the rights that the government protects of different Americans in different contexts. So one of the big problems has always been that the government tends to view nonviolent civil disobedience as terrorism. In the early part after 9/11, a lot of protest groups started to feel that they were under scrutiny and worked with the ACLU to use the Privacy Act to get information that the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force was spying on them. And the ACLU received hundreds of documents showing that they were spying on various groups. And then
even
actually,
just church groups and pacifist groups
right.
and any old kind
yep.
of group that might
right.
be against the government.
Anti-war groups, environmental groups, all kinds of different groups. And the FBI actually lied about it to Congress. They made up a fake story to justify their spying activity against one of the peace groups. And an inspector general investigation started that lasted 6 years. Four years. It was
years.
Published in 2010. And what they found was that the FBI was using these the watered-down guidelines that allow them to open an investigation based on a mere allegation. They don't need reasonable evidence. They just need a mere allegation. And that the agents themselves were making the allegations
yes.
To target these groups and then keeping the investigations open too long. The people who were subject to these investigations were put on terrorist watch lists. It had a real effect. And one of the things that the inspector general criticized was the FBI continuing to use nonviolent civil disobedience as a predicate for a terrorism investigation. And that's really a big part of the problem.
That's a very important point, isn't it? You know, we have another caller on the line, Michael. Let's get her in here. It's Suzanne. Good morning, Suzanne.
Yes. Hi. I worked for a couple of years in the crime lab at Cal Berkeley. And, you know, we would not go forward taking a case without evidence. And evidence, of course, as you know, is a, you know, a bloody shirt or a gun or whatever. But the point was that English, pardon me, but it's the language of business and the law. And it's not very reliable when people use words. They usually are just opinions. And they're not really contributing to the evidence. What is going on here? Or what do we believe is happening here? And I feel that the courts, I've been on jury duty a lot, but the point is the courts don't require enough discipline from those who are testifying. I don't care what it is about.
They just plain don't require the evidence, huh?
Right, because a person's behavior is evidence, as well as right. All the chit-chat stuff they do on Facebook and so forth. But it really bothers the whole system, because I understand what you, officer, are saying, and I understand why you are saying it, and you are trying to get order, and reasonableness as to what goes with what. But the politicians are always getting in the way. Okay.
Thank you for the ears.
Carry on. When I worked in the crime lab, we were wonderful. We were crazy, but we had a 90% solve rate. Okay.
Yeah.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So that's actually something that I talk about in the book, because when you have an organization like the FBI that we give significant powers to for good reason, you know, they're the primary or the predominant law enforcement agency in our country. If police are corrupt, they're supposed to go investigate them. If politicians are corrupt and they're disrupting our system, the FBI is supposed to go after them. So they need these strong authorities. The problem is when it shifts from a law enforcement mission to a what they call a national security mission or a domestic intelligence mission, the meaning of those words gets blurrier, right? We know what evidence is. And as I say in my earlier book, you know, the rules of evidence aren't just arcane obstacles that we've created to make it harder to be a lawyer. They're actually there to ensure that the information is reliable. That's why we call it evidence. It's actually reliable information. And when we talk about intelligence, it's not reliable. It's rumor, it's innuendo, it's fragmentary pieces of information. And yet there's this idea that, well, if there's intelligence that these groups are doing something bad, they must be doing something bad. And that's where a lot of this problem lies, is that we're no longer using the language in a way that is addressing real threats, but rather allowing these agencies to imagine who might be a threat, to make their own allegations about who's problematic.
Yes.
And that allows them to go after protesters rather than actually people who are committing deadly violence.
Well, and I think that depending on your point of view, you view the same thing as a crime or not a crime. And I think that one thing that is true, and I think it affects what happens here in Portland with the Portland police, is that by and large, the public is uncomfortable with dissidents. They're uncomfortable with protesters, the larger right. American that doesn't mean they're opposed to it. And when it comes down to it, all those teachers were protesters, and maybe many of them had never protested in the streets before.
Right.
But there still is this go ahead.
And that's the purpose of protest, right?
Yeah.
And the purpose of protest is to disrupt the status quo, to say that, no, we're not going to be content to sit back and just allow things to happen. We want in a democracy to have the ability to influence policy. So it's taking that discomfort that protest creates and turning it into a security issue, which in most cases it is not.
And scaring people even more. You know, right. In Portland, if you're smart, you're more afraid of the police than you are of the regular protesters, because you're much more, I think it could be statistically proven, actually, much more likely to be injured by the police than you are by another protester down there, with the exception of the Proud Boys who come into town to get into fights with people and attack people. We do have a couple more callers on the line, so let's get to them. That's LJ. Good morning, LJ.
Well, good morning, Linda. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for calling in.
Good. Well, thank you for the show. Just a couple of really quick points, and I'll get off the air. As far as the white nationalists are concerned, we are a threat to them. They view us as being a threat to the culture of the United States. And that's the reason, I think, for the reaction or the overreaction that they are demonstrating. They really think that we the collective we, who are protesting, etc., are a threat to the system. And I want to know what you guys think about that. And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I think we are a threat to the system in the sense that this where the system is wrong, we take it on.
Right, and that's exactly what.
But
what
the threat
we
to the system isn't a threat to the citizens.
Exactly. That I'm not aware that there are white nationalists being assassinated across the country.
No.
Right.
Yeah.
That that's what I was talking about with civil disobedience and with protests. That it is a threat to the status quo. Powers, the financial establishment, the political establishment. It does threaten them, but it doesn't threaten them from a security standpoint. It threatens them from a political standpoint. And unfortunately, when we're in these, typically it was around World War I that the FBI was unleashed to go after the labor movement and the peace movement. Around World War II, that they were unleashed to go after communists and socialists and the New Left, as they called it, and Black Liberation movements.
AIM, American Indian Movement, the Chicano movements, all of those were
going after. Any group that was agitating for social change became a target of this law enforcement agency. And it's the same way today, now that the rules are watered down again, that they can target groups that pose a political threat to the establishment, which is why I think they passed in the early 2000s the broad laws targeting animal rights protesters and environmental rights protesters was because it's a challenge to the establishment, and that's what they're trying to protect. So when they mix that security issue with the political issue is when the agency is no longer there to protect us, but is rather damaging our ability to influence our government. And that's where it damages democracy.
Well, I think that's really an important point. And I think when you add on the incredible abilities that they have through surveillance now, by surveillance I include everything from social media, et cetera, that they run through their fusion centers, they really have a lot more power to go after people they want to go after than they ever did before.
And it's fascinating because we're actually at one of the safer points our country has ever been at. Terrorism is much reduced from where it was in the 1970s. Violent crime is seriously down from the 1980s and 90s. And yet, as the homicide rate has gone down in this country, so has the rate at which police solve homicides. Even though there are fewer homicides, fewer are being solved. In the last 2 years that were reported, 2016 and 2017, 40% of homicides aren't solved in a year. So that's 6,500 deaths that don't get solved. And if you look at other violent crimes like rape, it's almost 60% don't get solved. And that's reported rapes, the rapes that the police know about. And of course, we know that many rapes aren't reported because they know the police don't investigate them. So even though we've built this intelligence apparatus, the chances of getting away with violent crime have gone up, because we're again looking at what
we're looking in the wrong direction,
perceive as what are potential threats on the horizon, rather than what is actually impacting the safety and security of American citizens in the communities they live in.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Michael German, for being on with me today. I'm speaking with Michael German. He is a former FBI special agent, turned to be a critic, actually, of the FBI. And we're talking about his most recent article on the new bill that's trying to be passed. His most recent article is called... I can't find it in front of me, so I'm not going to say it. Michael, can you say it?
I don't write the titles, but it's
I know,
like,
we're all going
what
into
is, what is what is Adam Schiff thinking with the new domestic terrorism?
That's right. What in the world is Adam Schiff thinking with his domestic terrorism bill? That's in The Hill, and you can find that. But I also want to mention the book that you're going to be coming out this next month on the 10th. It's called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, Now the New FBI, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Really important title. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Michael.
Thank you. I appreciate it,
and I appreciate your expertise and the depth of information that you bring to our audience. I also want to thank all the people who called in and all the listeners. I'm sorry I didn't get to Tim, our latest caller. Tim, I will not neglect you in the future, I promise. And thank you to our engineer, Ty, for all the great help today. Next up will be the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Heal Right Workshop series for those who identify as Black, Indigenous, or a person of color.
The Heal Right Workshop series is an opportunity for emerging writers of color to connect, share, create, and constructively critique with others that can relate.
The workshops are on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon, and the deadline to register is September 6th, 2019.
Again, that's the Heal Right Workshop series for people who are Black, Indigenous, or POC. The deadline to apply is September 6th.
More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.